Today we're going to begin the book of Job. Now we've been looking at the book of Genesis, Moses' big book of beginnings, and last session I showed you how the book of Exodus is closely connected to the book of Genesis. But during that 400 years between the end of the book of Genesis and the beginning of the book of Exodus, I think this story in the book of Job takes place. And so that's why we're putting it here chronologically. And here's my reasons for believing that. First of all, there are people and people groups mentioned in the book of Job that are clearly descended from Abraham. So it has to be post-Abraham. And far enough that these are people groups and not just simply a family. Secondly, as significant as Israel was once they entered into the Promised Land, they certainly would have been mentioned in the book of Job if they were in the land. But Israel is not mentioned even once in the book of Job. So I believe that's good enough reason to believe that we are in that period between the end of Genesis and the beginning of Exodus. And with that background, let's go ahead and dive into the text itself. Job 1:1. And by the way, his name in Hebrew is Yob, with a Y sound and a long O sound. And that will help not get confused and pronounce his name as Job, which I've heard some people say. There was a man in the land of Uz. Now, the land of Uz appears to be somewhere close to the Promised Land. In fact, somewhere close to Edom. In Jeremiah chapter number 25, we've got Pharaoh, who is apparently interacting with some people groups of this time period. The time period being about in the 580s, 590s, during the time leading up to the destruction of Israel in 587. So Jeremiah 25:20, Pharaoh is mixing it up with all the mixed tribes among them, all the kings of the land of Uz, so that's our same country, and all the kings of the land of the Philistines, Ashkelon, Gaza, Ekron, and the remnant of Ashdod, so that'd be on the coast, the southwest coast of the Promised Land, Edom, Moab, and the sons of Ammon. So those are all on the east side of the Dead Sea, and a little bit southeast of the Dead Sea. And then verse 22, all the kings of Tyre and Sidon, and the kings of the coastland above the sea. So that's up to the north side of the Promised Land. Dedan, Dima, Buz, and all who cut the corners of their hair. And then all the kings of Arabia. So it is clear from that passage that Uz is somewhere in the lower Middle East. Now we also have something in the book of Lamentations, chapter 4, verse 21. Rejoice and be glad, O daughter of Edom, who dwells in the land of Uz. And so from that, not only do we know that Uz must be somewhere in the lower Middle East, it is also very tightly associated with the country of Edom, which is southeast of the Dead Sea. And then finally, when you go to the book of Exodus to see what the origin of the people group of Uz might be, you've got a few options, but I think because of the Edom connection, The best option can be referenced in Genesis 36, starting at verse 20, where we have a genealogy of Esau to begin with, but then his in-laws as a tie-in. It says, these are the sons of Seir the Horite, the inhabitants of the land. And that would be the land of Seir, or the land of Mount Seir, which becomes Edom, southeast of the sea, the Dead Sea. So here is the names of Seir's sons: Lotan, Shobal, Zibeon. Zibeon is the father of the father-in-law of Esau. Anna, Dishon, which would make Dishon, I suppose we'd say, the uncle-in-law of Esau. And these are the chiefs of the Horites. And then if you go all the way down to verse 28, these are the sons of Dishon, Uz and Aran. And so that, I believe, is the people group we're talking about. Uz would have been the grandnephew of Esau and his wife, Oholibamah, the daughter of Anah. So from that, I believe that the land of Uz that we're talking about is somewhere to the south of Edom, which generally we think of that area belonging to Midian. And so I think it's possible a little bit south of that as well. So maybe along the east side of the Gulf of Aqaba, somewhere in that region. All right, so there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And Job means apparently hated. Now that's why would he have a name like that? We have no clue. But that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. So as we begin this story, it is important to understand that Job is a good man. He is a righteous man. He is a man that does things God's way. He reveres God. He avoids evil things. Now, this is before there was a written law. So everything that he's doing is either from traditions passed down to him from his forefathers who revered God and respected God, or from some sort of interaction, supernatural interaction, that Job himself had with God. Verse 2, there were born to him 7 sons and 3 daughters. So he's got a very good-sized family. He possessed, now listen to this, this makes him as rich, possibly richer, than Jacob was when he left the promised land and went to Egypt. This is another reason why I think this story takes place in between Genesis and Exodus, because I think that Jacob's family is all out of the picture of the lower Middle East at the time of this story. So Job possessed 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen. So if it's double yoke, that'd be 1,000. 500 female donkeys, and more than likely got male donkeys that match this to keep breeding stock, and very many servants. See, if you're going to run that many animals, you have to have a lot of employees. So that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. Now, we've seen this phrase, people of the East before, that it relates to the people living to the east of Canaan, the place where the promised land is allocated. And so that matches what we already talked about, that Uz is somewhere probably to the southeast of Canaan. Now, his sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each one on his day. That tells me that his sons are all of majority age. They are all adults. So let's just shortcut it and say they're probably all in their 20s at the minimum. I believe it is likely from that that Job is somewhere in his 40s and his wife of similar age. And the reason I mention that is because once this story comes to its completion at the end of the book, Job and Mrs. Job start a brand new family. And so that means they have to still be of an age where they can start over with brand new kids. And that seems to indicate somewhere in their 40s. All right, so his sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each one on his day. I think that's probably his birthday. Although I think I've seen a few commentaries try to suggest that these guys have a feast for every day of the week. And since there's seven sons, they just go house to house, depending on which day of the week it is. I think it makes more sense that we're talking about seven festivals during the entire calendar year, one for each of their birthdays. But they would send and invite their three sisters to eat and drink with them. And so it's some sort of big party, and their sisters, whether they're married or not married, they come. If they're married, they probably bring their families with them. So when the days of the feast had run their course, meaning we came to the last one in the calendar year, Job would send and consecrate them, and he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Now, that doesn't mean he believes that his kids are rotten and that he thinks that they are engaging in misbehavior at these festivals and that he's got to talk to God on their behalf. It's only saying that he was concerned that they might have inadvertently done something, and he wanted to talk to God about that on their behalf. It just tells you how kind-hearted he is, how loving of a father he is, that even when his kids are out on their own, he still worries about them. And, you know, good parents do that. And thus Job did continually. So it's of a habit. So that's what's been going on planet Earth with Job and his family. Now the scene shifts, and we look into the unseen world. So whoever is writing this is a prophet that is in touch with the work of the Holy Spirit. Now I'm going to suggest to you something that I honestly have not seen in other places. It may be out there. I might have actually read it myself, and it prompted me to kind of go down this route, but I don't remember that. I believe that it is likely that Moses is the author of this book, and here's my reason for it. Starting here in verse 6, you will see the use of the divine name of God, Yahweh. In our text, it is usually presented as Lord in special typing format. We know that that divine name is not known previous to the experience of Moses at Mount Sinai in the 80th year of his life, as recorded in Exodus chapter 3. So if this book, as I believe, is detailing information or detailing events previous to Israel coming back to the Promised Land, then how come the name of God is attached here? And we know that Moses did that in the book of Genesis. I repeated it to you multiple times as we were studying, that Even though Moses inserts the divine name here, this is not the name by which the people of the period knew God. Moses just wants everybody to understand this is the God we're talking about here. So I think the exact same thing happens here, and it is probably Moses doing it. I think he may have come into contact with the story when he was living in the region near Uz, because he lived for 40 years in Midian, which is just south of Edom, and therefore I think very close to Uz itself. And then God may have given him additional information about that story. But regardless, whoever is writing this knows the backstory. He knows what was going on in the heavenly realms. And it is important for us to absorb this information to make sense of the rest of the book. Verse number 6. Now there was a day when the sons of God. Now in Hebrew, this is Ha B'nei Elohim. And it is a reference to angels. And I believe in the Greek text, let me double check myself before I say it. I believe in the Greek text, it actually uses angels. Yep, there it is right there. Ha angeloi, the angels of God. And so this is clearly an angelic story that we are reading here. So there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before He who is, the creator of heaven and earth, the one true God. And then something that puzzles a lot of people. And Satan also came among them. Now Satan is Hebrew for the adversary. And we know it is the name of the fallen angel, Halel, the one that caused all the trouble back in Genesis chapter 3, and the one that's been the enemy of humanity ever since that time. What in the world would he be doing coming into the presence of God? Well, I have a theory on that, and I want to present it to you. I believe that when Satan and his angels rebelled against God, and the first action that they took was the events of Genesis chapter 3, the compromising of Adam and Eve, or put it in the proper order, Eve and Adam. I believe that they were punished by God with certain conditions placed on them in their continued interaction with humanity. And I believe that key within those conditions was, you may not violate human free will. So you can interact with them, you can manipulate them, but you can't violate their free will. I come up with this in part because we know that the angels of Genesis chapter 6, who took human women and used them for breeding purposes of some sort, they were grabbed out of this world by God and placed in what the Greeks referred to as Tartarus, the bottom part of Hades, the confinement area of the most wicked individuals who are no longer in bodily form on planet Earth. God took those angels and put them in chains of darkness to be kept until the day of judgment. And that this place of confinement also was referred to as the abyssus, or the abyss. And the reason that they were put there was because they violated free will of human beings and monkeying around with the human genome. So in the New Testament, gospel stories, we have some angels, fallen angels, demons, that have possessed a man. And this man has the name Legion because there's a whole bunch of these demonic beings that have control of him. And when Jesus comes into their presence, they beg him through the voice of the man, "We know who you are. You're the Son of God. What have we got to do with you?" And then listen to this next line. "Please do not send us into the abyss. Send us into those pigs over there instead." And so what terrorized them most was the idea that Jesus, as God, might confine them to this abyss until the end of Earth's history. So from all of that information, I believe that all the bad angels, all the fallen angels, are only allowed to interact with human beings provided they do not violate free will. If they do, they risk being sent to the abyss, like those before them that did exactly that. Now, when you're on parole like that, you have to come from time to time before an official and give an account for how you're keeping your parole. You're going to be evaluated as to whether or not you're keeping your parole. So in my estimation, what we see here in Job 1:6 is Satan and other angels showing up for their scheduled parole hearing to see if they're behaving themselves. And I think that puts a whole new flavor on the conversation that's about to happen. Let's read it again. "Now there was a day when the Habene Elohim, the sons of God, the angels of God, came to present themselves before He who is. And Satan also came among them. And He who is said to Satan, 'From where have you come?'" So, where have you been? "Satan answered He who is and said, 'From going to and fro on the earth and from walking up and down on it.'" So Satan, we know, is referred to as the god of this world, the power being of this world. He is the prince of the power of the air, which is a way of saying the breathable atmosphere. So he is the guy that's kind of like the gang leader here inside the human sphere of the world. And so he says, "I've been going all over the place, interacting with people." "He who is said to Satan, 'Have you considered my servant Job? There is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil.'" Now you'll recognize that last phrase there as coming from the beginning of the book, the description of Job. Now, some of the commentators, some of the preachers of the past, have said that God was basically challenging Satan to a test here of Job. I don't think so. I think God is basically saying, "Have you been looking around at my servant Job? Have you been sniffing around at Job? Have you been wandering around checking Job out? Are you casing him? Well, you ought to understand he is a blameless and upright man." And so I think God is basically aware that Satan has been going around the fringes of Job trying to figure out how to break this guy that is such a good example of God people. And so Satan says back, "Well, does Job fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side?" So Satan clearly knows about Job. He knows Job's situation. He also knows that Job is protected by God. He says, you got a hedge around the guy. You got a fence that I can't get through. So that tells me he's been trying to figure out a way to get through that fence. He continues, you've blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But now, here's the real challenge about Job. It comes from Satan. He's the one that issues the challenge. Verse 11, but stretch out your hand, touch all that he has, he will curse you to your face. So Satan's challenge is, yeah, I know who you're talking about, but I'm telling you, the only reason he worships you, the only reason he follows you and loves you and does all the things that he does in your name is because you've blessed him. If you allow me to take that stuff away, you'll find out how he really feels about you. Verse number 12. Satan, Yahweh, or he who is, said to Satan, behold, all that he has is in your hand. So this is the place where God gives limited permission for Satan to pierce the hedge of protection. Only against him do not stretch out your hand. So yes, you may touch his family, his friends, his property, but you can't touch him. And so Satan went out from the presence of he who is to do exactly what we're going to read next. Now, before we close today, I want to remind you of a Bible principle. 1 Corinthians 10:13. No temptation has come on you except that which is common to all mankind, and God is faithful in that he will not allow you to be tempted or tested beyond what you're able, and with the testing or the tempting will provide a way of escape that you may be able to endure it. Keep that in mind during our story.